Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, tonight we will be taking for a study. This is the Maha Rahula Ovada Sutta. This is translated as the Greater Discourse of Advice to Rahula. And this is Sutta number 62 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, now some time ago, actually, it's probably several years ago, we had studied the Sutta number 61 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Ambalattika Rahula Ovada Sutta. This is a short sutta of advice to Rahula, which was given at a place called Ambalattika. Ambalattika would mean the mango creeper. Okay, now, who is the subject of this discourse? Rahula. Rahula was the fleshly son of the Buddha. Before the Buddha's enlightenment, even before the Buddha renounced the household life to seek enlightenment, when he was living as a prince of the Sakyans in Kapalavattu, the capital city of the Sakyans, it said at the age of 16, he married. Okay, so Rahula was the son, when the Buddha was still living in the palace as a prince of the Sakyans, at the age of 16, he married a princess of the neighboring republic. Those people were called the Koliyans. And her name, it's said to be Yasodhara, the name of his wife. And then, according to the traditional account, for many years they didn't give birth, the wife did not give birth to any child, except in his 29th year, that would be 13 years after they were married, on the very day that he decided that he would renounce the household life and become a seeker of enlightenment, his wife gave birth to a little baby boy. And so the prince, when he received the news that the little boy had been born, that his wife had given birth to a baby, he said, "Now a fetter has arisen for me." And somehow the word Rahula comes to mean a fetter, because he thought that the son would now be a fetter preventing him from renouncing the household life. Actually, the story seems a little questionable because if his wife was pregnant, he would have already known that she's going to give birth to a baby and that the baby would be in some way a bond for him. But this is the traditional account. Maybe to make it more dramatic, they have the baby born on the very day that he decides to renounce. And so that night, his wife was lying in the bed with the baby by her side, but the prince got up in the middle of the night, walked towards the door, turned around, and gave one final glance at his wife and child. Maybe he hesitated for a moment, unsure what decision to make. Then he remained firm in his decision. And he went out the door, left the palace while everyone was asleep, and then entered the forest, cut off his hair, changed his robes for his royal attire for rag robes, and then became an ascetic seeking enlightenment. But meanwhile, back in the palace, the little boy was growing up for 7 years without ever having seen his father. Okay, and so 6 years after the Buddha left the palace, he achieved enlightenment and became the enlightened one, the Buddha. Then his father sent messengers to him to urge him, to plead with him to come back to visit his home city, Kapalavastu. And so finally the Buddha made the decision to go back to the city to visit his family. And so he came with the community of monks, a large company of monks. And then as he was walking through the street, his wife was in the palace looking down in the at the street with little Rahula by her side. And then when the Buddha came walking down the street, his wife pointed down and said to Rahula, "That is your father." When Rahula saw his father, he was very impressed that the Buddha was walking with such a majestic gait, and his features looked so handsome and so serene. And so Rahula said, "I'm really impressed by my father." Then his wife said to Rahula, "Go to your father and ask him for your inheritance, because as a prince, he would have had so much wealth, gold and silver, jewels." And so she thought Rahula should receive all of this wealth that the prince would have had. And so Rahula came up to the Buddha and said to him, "Great ascetic, even your shadow is pleasing to me." And then he said, "My mother says to me that I should ask you, please give me my inheritance." Then the Buddha stopped and thought to himself, "Should I give him an inheritance of gold and silver, which is just bound to fade away and isn't really satisfying? Or should I give him the inheritance of what I've achieved? Enlightenment, liberation, eternal bliss, the deathless state." Then he turned to his chief disciple, Sariputta, and said, "Ordain him." And so at the age of 7, Rahula was ordained as a novice, a Samanera. Okay, and so when Rahula was a newly ordained monk, it seems in playfulness he might have been speaking some falsehoods, the way little boys do. And so one day his father called him and then gave Rahula a lecture on the need to always speak the truth. And that lecture is what's been recorded as Sutta number 61 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the short discourse to Rahula at Ambalatika. Now, the sutta that we're going to be studying today, Sutta number 62, this takes place some years later. According to the commentary, this sutta was spoken to Rahula when Rahula was 18 years old. And so now 11 years have gone by since the Buddha gave that first discourse to Rahula on speaking the truth. And so there's a background to the sutta, a background story which explains why the Buddha gave the instruction that he did. At the beginning of the sutta, we can see that one day the Buddha dressed, he took his bowl and his outer robe, and he started to walk towards Savatthi on alms round. And then his son Rahula also dressed, took his alms bowl, and started to walk to Savatthi, walking closely behind the Buddha. Then as they were walking together, Rahula looked ahead at his father, the Buddha, walking with such a magnificent physical form. The Buddha at this time, 1835, would have been 53 years old. So you could say in the autumn of life, but still endowed with a majestic physical body because he came from the Kshatriya clan, the warrior clan. So the Sakyans were strong mountain people. And so his body would have been tall, strongly built, his features very handsome, very radiant. And so then Rahula looked at the Buddha's body walking ahead of him and was so impressive. Then he reflected on his own body and saw that he too had inherited basically the same genetic code. So his face looked like that of the Buddha. His body was also strong. Now he's 18 years old, just the height of adolescence. He's recognizing his physical beauty, thinking that I'm so handsome. And the two of us, he thought, walking together, this is like an elder swan walking with a little young swan behind him. Or it's like a bull elephant. In India, the elephant is considered, at least certain elephants, a symbol of beauty, strength, majesty, and beauty. So this is like a bull elephant walking, and I'm like an elephant cub. Or it's like the Buddha is like the full moon, and I'm like the morning star. And then he thought, if the Buddha hadn't renounced the household life, he would have been a king, and I would have been a prince, and both of us together reigning in the same kingdom, we would have glorified our state. And so as Rahula was thinking in this way, the Buddha walking ahead of him, the Buddha thought to himself, what is Rahula thinking now? And then because he has the power of reading the minds of others, he turned his own mind to Rahula, and he was able to read the thoughts going through Rahula's mind. And he saw that Rahula was thinking these thoughts that were motivated by pride, by attachment to the body, by thoughts, worldly thoughts of he wanted the Buddha to give up his Buddhahood or his ascetic status and go back to rule as a king so that he could become a prince. And so the Buddha thought, it's important now for me to give some instruction to Rahula to teach him how to overcome these deluded thoughts, which are based primarily by clinging to the body, by identifying with the body. And so at this point, we come to paragraph 3 in the sutta, where it says, the Blessed One looked back and he addressed Venerable Rahula thus. Rahula, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom, with correct wisdom, with right understanding, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And so we see that the Buddha formulates this teaching specifically in regard to the aggregate of material form, because material form, what the body consists of, is rupa, material form. And so now the Buddha is giving Rahula very concise instructions on how to overcome this false thinking based on material form. Since Rahula's thoughts of pride, because he has a handsome body, and because the Buddha is physically strong and handsome, thoughts of craving based on the body. Now it's the idea of returning to the household life so he could exercise power as a prince. And maybe since he's 18 years old, this is the age when sensual desire starts. Well, actually, it's more than started, but the sensual desire can be gaining in strength, especially the sexual desire. And so he wants to stem and prevent the sexual desire from increasing in strength. And so he gives Rahula this very concise instruction on uprooting attachment to the body and identification with the body. And so he takes all the different aspects of material form, no matter what time period, whether it's in oneself or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form is included in this. And this form should be seen in three ways: netang mama, ne so hamasmi, ne so me ataha. It's not mine, it is not I, it is not myself. Okay, so the Buddha very often uses this concise formula with the three terms. And according to the commentaries, the Pali commentaries, the reason why the Buddha uses these three terms is to uproot three types of false thinking, of deluded thinking. The first type of deluded thinking is the thought, this is mine. And this thought, this is mine, this is said to be symptomatic of craving. And craving is a kind of attachment. And so when one thinks the body is mine, then one becomes attached to the body. And one becomes very concerned, oh, am I beautiful, not so beautiful? is my hair well, of course, you should comb the hair properly, brush it properly, don't look slovenly, but when one thinks the body is mine, then some people become proud and conceited and arrogant and vain if they're handsome or beautiful. Other people who are not so beautiful, not so strong, not so impressive, they become depressed, dejected, and they get kind of some kind of inferiority complex because of the body. And so people build up these false thoughts based on the thought, this body is mine. And then because of that thought, this is mine, then one becomes attached to the body. And that attachment, that's a form of craving. And then the second type of false thinking, false thought, is this is I. I am the body. Also, when one thinks I am the body, this is a form of identification. One identifies with the body. And it's said that the thought, this is I am the body, this becomes the basis for conceit. If one is handsome and beautiful, it gives rise to conceit. If one doesn't consider oneself to be handsome or beautiful, then it can give rise to this kind of dejection, which according to Buddhism is just, it's another form of conceit. Okay, and then the third type of false thinking is the thinking, is the thought, this is myself. And this is considered, it's another type of identification, but this is a kind of identification which turns into a wrong view. That is, one takes the body to be one's personal self. And so this can lead to a philosophical view of materialism. I am the body, and so when the body dies, everything about me comes to an end. That would be an annihilationist view, a materialistic view. Okay, so of these three types of false thinking, the first is a type of attachment, the false thinking based on craving. And the second two, the thought, this I am, this is myself, these are two types of false thinking which are two types of false thinking which lead to identification with the body. And one, this I am, is a form of conceit, or it leads to conceit. And this is myself. This is a type of identification which leads to a wrong view of the body. And so to eliminate these three types of false thinking, distorted thinking, the Buddha teaches this triple contemplation. This is not mine. When one goes on contemplating the body again and again, this is not mine. This will uproot the attachment to the body. It doesn't mean that one becomes negligent about the body and doesn't shave, doesn't wash, doesn't brush one's teeth, doesn't dress neatly, but one isn't concerned very much about the body. So whether the body is, whether one's face is beautiful, not so beautiful, doesn't matter. When one gets ill, one could take it with equanimity. When one grows old, one could accept it with equanimity. When one has to die, one can give up the body. Okay, and so contemplating the body, this is not mine, uproots, weakens, and then eventually uproots the attachment to the body. Contemplating the body, this is not I, this uproots conceit about the body. And so one doesn't think, when one observes the body, contemplates the body, I am not this, then one doesn't think on the basis of the body, I am better, I am the true Miss Universe, Miss America, Mr. What is the male counterpart? Is there a male counterpart?
Mr. Universe.
Mr. Universe, they have a, okay, I don't know. Or I'm the handsome movie star. I remember when I was a little boy, I told my mother, when I grow up, I want to be a movie star. You know what she said to me? You're not handsome enough to be a movie star. Oh, it really hit me so hard. What do you mean you're not handsome? I'm not handsome enough to be a movie star. And it strengthened my determination to become a movie star. If my mother knew at that time that I was going to turn out to be a Buddhist monk, she would have enrolled me in acting lessons. Okay, and so one doesn't have the conceit, superiority conceit, or the inferiority conceit. One just accepts the body the way it is. And then when one contemplates the body, this is not myself, when one understands the principle that the body is not self, then one doesn't form any views based on the body, any view of self, which is another basis for clinging. Okay, so in this passage, the Buddha has taught Rahula very concisely the contemplation of non-self based on the body, the aggregate of material form. But now, Venerable Rahula, of course, he's been over the last 10, 11 years, he's been exposed to the Buddha's teaching many times. And so he would have heard the Buddha speaking about all five aggregates. And so Rahula asked the Buddha, should I practice this meditation only on material form? Then the Buddha fills out the instructions and says, practice on material form, and also practice on feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So now the Buddha brings in all five aggregates. All five aggregates are to be contemplated as not self. And so whatever feeling there is, whatever perception there is, whatever mental formations or volitional states there are, whatever consciousness there is, Rahula is to contemplate them all as being not mine, not I, not myself. And so here the Buddha is cutting off all the bases of attachment for Rahula. Okay, so we have to remember that they've been walking towards the village or the town to go on alms round. But now Rahula got these instructions, meditation instructions, from the Buddha. And so when he receives the instructions, then he thinks to himself, when somebody is personally admonished by the Blessed One, by the Buddha, how could he think about going into town on alms round? So now these instructions must have been impressed very strongly on his mind. It seems that when the Buddha gives teachings, when the teaching comes directly from his mouth, in his presence, the teaching has a very potent effect on the mind. And so, as Rahula was listening to this discourse given specifically to him, very pointedly to him, his mind would have been inspired, uplifted, full of joy at this opportunity. And so he thinks, why should I be concerned with going into the town to go on alms round? If he misses the meal for the day, he's not going to perish from famine. And so he thinks it's better that I use my time to practice meditation in accordance with the instruction of the Buddha. Okay, so he turned back. I'm not sure whether he went back to the monastery or just found a convenient tree nearby. But anyway, he sits down at the foot of a tree, crosses his legs, and then he sets up mindfulness in front of him. Okay, now after Rahula is sitting there for some time, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, Venerable Sariputta comes walking by and sees him sitting there. And Venerable Sariputta says to him, Rahula, develop mindfulness of breathing. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. The commentary explains that when Sariputta was walking by and saw Rahula sitting there, because the sitting posture is the posture recommended for mindfulness of breathing, and he saw Rahula sitting with the legs crossed, the back straight, the eyes closed, he would have thought Rahula has taken the proper sitting posture for mindfulness of breathing. And Venerable Sariputta himself had practiced mindfulness of breathing and had benefited from it a lot. And so Venerable Sariputta instructed Rahula to practice mindfulness of breathing. Okay, so this created a bit of a conflict in Rahula's mind, because Rahula had first gotten the instruction from the Buddha on practicing the contemplation of the body, actually of the contemplation of all five aggregates as non-self. And now Sariputta has given him instruction to practice mindfulness of breathing. And Sariputta was Rahula's personal teacher. The Buddha wasn't Rahula's personal teacher. The Buddha was the head of the whole Sangha, but he wasn't the one who gave Rahula the ordination and guided his development. Sariputta was the one who took that responsibility. And according to the principles of the monastic order, one is supposed to follow the instruction of one's preceptor. And Sariputta is Rahula's preceptor. So Rahula was wondering, what should I do? The Buddha, of course, is the master, so he teaches me to practice the meditation on non-self. My personal teacher and preceptor, Sariputta, teaches me to practice mindfulness of breathing. So what should I do? And so in the evening, he goes to the Buddha and he asks, how does one practice mindfulness of breathing? Perhaps he had heard the Buddha give just general instructions on mindfulness of breathing, but never had detailed instructions on mindfulness of breathing. And so now he wants to ask, how does one practice this meditation so that it will bring its full benefits? Okay, but now the Buddha speaks to Rahula, But he doesn't answer Rahula's question immediately. Instead, he's going to give Rahula instructions on another meditation subject. This will be the meditation subject of the five elements. Usually we speak about four elements, but now to make it more complete, the Buddha includes the fifth element, the fifth material element, which is the space element. Actually, some suttas speak about six elements. The six elements are earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. Consciousness, in the context of the elements, includes the whole mental side of a living being. It includes consciousness and the other mental factors that arise along with consciousness. And the material side of the living being is represented by the first five elements. So we have the four primary elements, earth, water, fire, and air, and then the space element. So the Buddha begins by giving Rahula instruction on how to contemplate the four great elements, starting with the earth element. So now we're in paragraph 8. The Buddha says, Rahula... Okay, now why does the Buddha give the instruction? Why doesn't he answer Rahula's question directly and start explaining mindfulness of breathing? Anybody have any idea? What would be too abstract? I'm not sure that that's the answer. Yeah.
Maybe contemplate the fourth element is a better antidote to what Rahula's claiming of his body form.
Okay, that's a good answer. Yeah, but it's a little bit different from the way I was thinking of it. But I was thinking that this is a way to elaborate on the contemplation of the body as being non-self. Maybe the contemplation of the body as being non-self was too concise an instruction for Rahula. And so now the Buddha, in order to make known more clearly the selfless nature of the body, is going to elaborate how one should observe the body in order to move into the contemplation of non-self. But by doing this, as you say, by elaborating the four or five elements, it helps Rahula to get more easily to get a grip on the idea of the body as non-self than simply saying, contemplate form as not mine, not I, not myself. That would be useful for somebody whose faculties, especially the faculty of wisdom, is already well-developed. But maybe Rahula's wisdom was not yet sufficiently developed. And so the Buddha, in order to help Rahula develop his insight, his wisdom, gives this more elaborate approach to observing the aggregate of form. And so when we look at suttas, which explain or define what is the aggregate of material form, for example, Sutta number 9. This will be on page 141. Here it's called materiality. paragraph 54, the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements, these are called materiality. Okay, so form is just the four great elements and types of material phenomena that are based on the four great elements. And so in order to understand how, to understand why material form is non-self, the most useful, the most effective, skillful means is to observe the body in terms of the four great elements. And so now the Buddha begins by taking the element of the earth element. So he says, paragraph 8, whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This expression, clung to, actually means something like organic, the organic part of the body. That is head hairs. Now the Buddha is going to enumerate 20 aspects of the body that exemplify the earth element. So he mentions head hairs, body hairs, nails, fingernails, toenails, teeth, skin, flesh, the sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, the large intestines, small intestines. Actually, that isn't quite correct. It should be antang. The first one is intestines, both the large and small intestines together. The second one is called mesentery. Mesentery is, it's a kind of binding material which holds the intestines in place, a kind of tissue that holds the intestines in place. Okay, then comes the stomach and its contents, then feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the earth element. Okay, now, in understanding the Buddhist philosophy of the elements, one has to first recognize that these four terms that are used, earth, water, fire, and air, actually represent what we would call four properties of material phenomena. So it doesn't mean that the earth element is the planet Earth, and that the water element is just the water in the ocean or the lake or the water that comes out of the tap. But these are just terms of common usage that the Buddha has taken to represent specific aspects of material phenomena. Okay, so the earth element is the property of solidity. It's the solid aspect of matter, that aspect or property by which matter occupies space. In occupying space, the matter gives resistance. And the earth element is said to be the side of the aspect of matter or the property that supports the other elements. And now, according to Buddhism, in any material entity contains all four elements. All four of them always coexist. So if we take something solid, like this pen, the pen conventionally speaking, we could say it represents the earth element, but that's only because the earth element is most prominent in this object. But within the earth, within the pen, there's also the water element. What is the water element? The water element is said to be the property that binds matter. It's the aspect of cohesion, the binding together. Because when one takes, say, particles of flour, if you've ever baked bread, if you take the flour, what do you do to make it, the particle, the flour, hold together? What do you do? You put water in. So the water is what enables the particles to attract each other. And if one wants to turn earth into clay so that one could mold it, again one adds water. To make bricks out of cement, one adds water. Okay, so the ancients said that the water element is the property of cohesion, and it's also the property of flowing or oozing. Then the fire element is the aspect of heat, the property of heat. So any object above absolute zero has some, and I don't think there's any object at absolute zero. So any object has some amount of heat, and that heat is the fire element. So even in this pen, there is heat. And then the air element or the wind element is the aspect of pressure or extension or distension. I'm sorry. Pressure or distension. Because if one takes a balloon, for example, and blows into it, the balloon swells up because of the air element. And also the air element is said to be the property of motion, because wind is always in motion, always moving. And so we have solidity, the four elements representing solidity, cohesion, heat, and motion or pressure. And so when the texts speak about certain parts of the body as representing the earth element, like the hairs of the head, body hairs, nails, and so on, we should understand that these parts are mentioned simply because the earth element is most prominent in these parts of the body. But also, the earth element is present throughout the body. Every part of the body has earth element. Okay, now all of these hard or solid parts of the body are called the internal earth element. And then the Buddha continues. He says, now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. This is a very important statement. And if one reflects on it, it's eye-opening. Because usually we think of the body, this is mine, and then we distinguish what lies within the boundaries of the skin, my body, everything else outside is external. But in fact, there's a constant interchange or exchange going on between the external and the internal. So we have food, for example, every day, several times a day. We take food. The food initially is external. So we could say the solid food is external earth element, but we eat it, chew it, swallow it, it goes into the stomach, and then the digestive process removes the parts of the food that are of nutritional value, and then that becomes metabolized and absorbed into the body. So it becomes, then it becomes internal earth element. And then parts of the body are constantly coming off and being emitted. The cells of the skin are always wearing off, becoming part of the outer world. When we go to the toilet and defecate, then the excrement coming from internal, inside the body, goes outside, and eventually the body dies and disintegrates, and so the internal earth element of the body becomes part of the external earth element of nature. And so when we use wisdom, then we see that the external earth element, even this tape, this desk, the chair, the cup, and this internal earth element that I call my body, are exactly the same in that they both have this, the property of solidity or hardness, the property of the earth element. Okay, and so when we are able to observe how there is this continuity and uniformity between the earth element of the body and the external earth element, then we can see that it's simply a false thought, a wrong thought, to identify anything of the internal earth element as being truly mine, truly I, truly myself. And so one sees, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, the earth, the internal earth element, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element, and one makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. Okay, and so with these instructions, the Buddha is showing Rahula how to remove that attachment to his body. One sees the earth element of the body as being not mine, not what I am, not myself. One sees it with wisdom. When one sees it with wisdom, then one becomes disenchanted with it. One no longer takes it to be mine, I, and myself. And then the mind becomes detached, or it gives up the attachment and craving for the earth element. Okay, maybe I'll ask whether there's any questions at this point. Please.
Similar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm having a difficult time separating.
Yeah, I understand that. Because they seem to be quite similar. And the only way I can explain the difference between them, I would say that the thought, this I am, is a kind of natural identification with the body, or maybe a kind of spontaneous, okay, a spontaneous, everyday identification with the body that ordinary people will think. Whereas the idea, this is myself, would be a more philosophically developed way of understanding the body. Because this, the word that's translated here as self is the word atta, or it's the Sanskrit atma. So this was the main, one of the main topics of philosophical speculation, discussion and discourse in the Buddha's time. And so this is, in a way, when the Buddha says to view the body, this is not I. It seems he's addressing more the way ordinary people will think of the body, simply taking the body to be I. But when he says, see the body, this is not myself, that seems more addressed to the people who are likely to indulge in the philosophical speculation. Is the body the self, our true essence? Yes. Yeah.
Sitting here.
Yeah.
There is a kind of a relationship. It's not mine or I or myself.
Yeah.
There's a sense of responsibility, a greater responsibility for these earth elements.
Yeah, yeah.
And the others.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly that's
kind of a relationship.
Yeah. Now certainly that is true. But I think the purpose of this way of contemplation is not to give up that sense of responsibility for taking care of one's own body, but to remove these, I call these the 3 points of attachment, the three types of false thinking. The false thinking based on attachment, the false thinking which gives rise to conceit, and the false thinking which gives rise to this view of a self. Yeah, don't let it become too, maybe we say too much tinged with subjectivity. Please.
Yeah, you speak of the conceit of inferiority.
Yeah.
And I'm always much more comfortable in seeing conceit of myself of I'm funny or witty or wise or whatever,
yeah, yeah,
or beautiful or whatever. And, when usually you're self-critical,
yeah,
and you say, well, I should do this better, or I'm, yeah, beautiful or not funny,
yeah,
to see that also as a conceit,
yeah,
just that opened my eyes. You know.
Yeah, but this is an interesting point in Buddhism that they speak, or the Buddhist texts speak about three kinds of conceit. One is called the conceit, I am better. That's what we, in English, we usually think of as conceit, is thinking I'm better than the others in this respect or that respect. The other is the conceit, I am equal or I am just as good as. So sometimes somebody might denigrate you, and then you come up and think, I'm just as good as you are. That's also a conceit. And then the third type of conceit is called the conceit, I am worse. Because what lies behind conceit is comparing oneself with others and then judging oneself on the basis of this comparison. And so one could judge oneself in any of these three ways. And all three ways are based at the root, or they're all rooted in this idea, I am, with a blank after it. And then you fill in the blank based on the comparison. Any further questions? Eva.
For the stream editor, they cover the three feathers, long view, and one of them is I or mine.
Okay, maybe please say the question again.
For stream editor,
yeah.
The definition of stream editor, they cover three feathers.
Right.
And one of them is long view.
Yeah.
And the other one is I?
No, no. What the stream enterer has cut off, the fetter, that's Sakkaya Ditti, or what's sometimes translated identity view. So this is the view of a self with, in regard to the five aggregates. And so the stream enterer has uprooted the thought, this is myself. That is completely cut off. But the stream enterer could still think, this is mine and this I am. He'll still have the thoughts of craving, which give rise to the idea of mine, thoughts of attachment, and he'll still have the idea I am, which gives rise to conceit. In order to overcome, to cut off those fetters, he has to practice further to gain deeper insight. Any further questions? Okay, maybe we'll try to get another element in. Okay, now we come to the water element. Okay, the water element also might be either internal or external. What is the internal water element? Okay, now the Buddha will mention 12 constituents of the body in which the water element is prominent. Okay, so whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to or organic. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, the oil of the joints that enable one to bend the arms and legs, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. This is called the internal water element. So in these parts of the body, the water element is prominent, but there's also the earth element is there, because all of these parts of the body have some resistance. If one compresses the liquid parts, there's some resistance. That is the part which is the solid part, the earth element. They will have bodily heat. That's the fire element. And there'll be movement amongst them. That is the air element. Okay, and so both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. We drink water, here I'm drinking tea. Now this is external. When I drink it, it comes into me, it gets absorbed into the body. It becomes internal water element. And maybe when the class is over, then I will go to the bathroom and make pee-pee. Then the water or drink that I drank earlier in the afternoon, that will become external water element. Okay, so the internal water element, external water element, they're simply water element. They both have this common property of fluidity, of fluidity and of cohesion. So this too one sees as it really is, not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, then we'll go on to the fire element. The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to or organic. That is, that by which one is warmed, that would be the natural internal heat of the body, by which one ages. This seems to be an idea in Indian physiology. Maybe they observe that when fruit gets warm, it starts to turn more quickly, to decay more quickly. Whereas if we put the fruit in a refrigerator, we keep it cool, it lasts longer. So maybe on this, of course, the Indians didn't have refrigerators, but they would have noticed that, the ancient Indians, but they would have noticed that in cold weather, fruit will keep long, and other foods will keep longer than when the food is exposed to heat. And so the heat is what causes the body to age. And then eventually the body completely decays because of, they attribute this to the heat element. And that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. And so it's the heat element. Again, this is according to the Indian physiology. The stomach is a support or a receptacle for the heat element. Maybe this would be the hydrochloric acid in the stomach, which digests the food. And so the Indians believe that it's the heat element that is responsible for digestion. Okay, so, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. So this would be the heat element in all of the other parts of the body, the solid parts, the liquid parts. So all of this is called the internal fire element. Okay, now both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply the fire element, whether it's a fire outside, the heat of the sun. In fact, without the heat of the sun, there would be no life on earth, and no, we wouldn't have our own bodies, and so there would be no heat in our bodies. So the heat of the body depends upon the external heat. If the temperature of the earth were to drop to become permanently 40 degrees below zero, 50 degrees below zero, probably we couldn't survive. And so our life depends on the heat element. But the heat element shouldn't get too high. Okay, so the internal heat element, the external heat element, simply the internal fire element, the external fire element, simply the fire element. And this should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Again, one sees it, then one becomes disenchanted, and the mind becomes detached from the fire element. Okay, we'll go on to the air element. Okay, the air element is what has, that which has the property of motion, of movement, and expansion, contraction, distension. So the air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. That is upward going winds, downward going winds. Okay, now, again, I have to explain this with reference to the Indian physiology. According to the Indian physiology, what we would consider probably to be afferent. Does anybody know physiology? Neurology? Afferent, efferent? Nerve currents? Does that ring a bell with anybody? Trying to remember my high school biology. Okay, there are some nerve signals that bring sense impressions from the outside into the mind. Other nerve currents that are responsible for the movement of the limbs. Well, maybe there are nerve currents that go from the lower parts of the body up that bring in the sensation from the hands, legs, up to the mind. And then there are nerve currents which bring signals from the mind down to the limbs, enable us to move about. So in the Indian physiology, the upward going winds are the winds which bring the nerve currents, are the nerve currents which bring impressions through the arms and legs to the mind. And then the downward going winds would correspond to the nerve currents which transform signals in the mind, or volitions in the mind, transform the volitions of the mind into movement of the limbs. So the thought in the Indian physiology, a thought will stimulate the wind element, so that the wind element then will initiate movement. Okay, so there's upward going winds, downward going winds, winds or air in the belly, winds or air in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs. These again would be maybe minor types of nerve currents. And in-breath, out-breath, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself as air, airy and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Okay, so then, and we have to remember in all of the other parts of the body, the solid parts, the liquid parts, the hot, fiery parts, the air element is also present as that which is responsible for movement, pressure, expansion, contraction. Okay, so now the internal air element, the air that's already in the body, and the external air element are simply air element. And again, there's a constant exchange between them. I breathe in, I take the air from the outside into my body. In the lungs, the oxygen gets someplace inside, the oxygen gets separated out and absorbed into the cells. Carbon dioxide and waste gases get expelled from the cells, carried by the blood to the lungs, and then breathe it out through the lungs. And then when the air is breathed out, then it becomes part of the external air element. Okay, and so this air element should be seen as it really is, as it actually is, with proper wisdom. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, then just to finish, I'll go right into the space element. Now, according to the early Buddhist teaching, the space element is not all comprehensive space, like Newton's absolute space, but the space element is the empty space between particles of matter. Okay, so what is the internal space element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to, that's part of the body. That is the holes of the airs, the openings of the nostrils, the door of the mouth, and that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed. We would call this esophagus, is that what it's called?
You swallow when it goes down. Your esophagus is your stomach.
The esophagus is the stomach. Yeah, that is the sort of pipe, right? Yeah, that's the esophagus. Okay, so that aperture whereby what is eaten and so on gets swallowed, and where it collects, that would be the space of the stomach, and where it is excreted from below, that would be the open space of the anus. and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial. In my copy, I see I had the word I'd clung to crossed out here. Let me just, I have the Pali text here. Let me just check it. This Pali text has the word and that's translated and clung to. But I've crossed it out. There must have been another edition that doesn't have it. Don't worry about that anyway. Okay, so this is called the internal space element. Now, both the internal space element, that is the open spaces in the body, and the external space element, any open spaces externally, both of these are simply the space element. And also that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, maybe we'll stop at this point, and if there's any questions on the elements, please feel welcome to ask. No questions. Okay.
What's the significance of the space element? Why is that added in addition to the other four elements?
I think mainly just to be comprehensive. And because within the body one finds these open spaces. Now we would say that, you know, looking at it scientifically, what seems to be open space would be filled with particles of air. But also the particles of air would be moving about in space, so there would be open spaces between the molecule. There would be open spaces between the molecules of air. According to the commentary says that space is mentioned as one example of the matter derived from the four great elements. So earth, liquid, earth, water, fire, and air, those are the four great elements. Then space is said to be, the space element is derived from the four great elements in the sense that wherever there is open space not occupied by the four elements, that is the space element. Please.
And you drew a distinction from another kind of space.
Yeah. Often when we think about space, we think of space as being, let's say we have the spatio-temporal continuum. So space as being the three-dimensional space that includes everything. So the solid book occupies space. So this is a particular volume of space, okay, 8 inches, 8.5 inches high, 5.5 inches wide. So this is about 2 inches thick. Then one multiplies this, one gets a certain volume. So that's a particular volume of space. But in the early Buddhist way of understanding space, that would not be considered the space element. But the space element would be the open space that's not occupied visibly by anything else. So the space between these two books would be space element. But later Buddhism of some of the later schools speaks about the space element as being the all embracing space that would correspond to the absolute space of Newtonian physics. The space that includes everything, three-dimensional space.
And that would be the space within which the elements...
Exactly, yeah, the space, yeah, in which the other elements are situated. Suki? Yeah, That is exactly what the other space would be, infinite space. But go on, did you have a question? Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see, the meditation on infinite space. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Actually, that's a good idea. Except that when the space element is spoken about, it's always exemplified by spaces between objects. You're right that the texts do speak about the meditation, the formless meditation on the base of infinite space. So there is the concept of this infinite, all-embracing space. But that's not used to exemplify the space element. Yeah.
Sometimes you translate it that way.
Yeah.
And how do you know when you translate external as other people's something or outside of me?
You mean just part of the external world, not connected to a... Yeah.
And when you say internal water element is a water element within me,
right,
within my body, or external water element, it could have been translated as water element of other people. Sometimes, I mean, don't you
I would say to take the water, to take the expression external element, to refer exclusively to that element in other people, that would be too narrow an understanding. I think when one has the expression, the external earth element or external water element, it means any water element outside of what I conventionally call my body. So whether the water element is bound up with other living bodies, or whether the water element is in a lake, an ocean, the bathtub, the shower, it's still the external water element.
The reason why I'm bringing this up is in Satipatthana Sutta,
yeah,
you translate it as when you breathe, the breath of my breath, and external is the breath of other people.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that breathe that. I don't think I translate it as the breath of other people. I just. Yeah, yeah, but the way to explain it would be the breathing of other people or other living beings that breathe, since in the case of breath, I don't see breath occurring on its own apart from living bodies. But when it comes to the elements, we have the elements existing simply externally, inanimately, not being part of organic bodies. Okay, we're going to have to stop for the evening. Before I stop, I'll want to announce that I will give the next class on July 7th. That will be just 1 week from today. But because there'll be a class going on here, right? So we will have to have our class in the meeting room that's just above this room. And we'll record the lecture so those who are going to the Chinese class at the Dharma retreat could listen to the class over the website. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang oditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.